OYOTU.com.
Sign Language with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 145 of Sign Language. Something that I thought was rather nice to see that popped up on my feed through the week was a story on the Independent of the United Kingdom's website about a plaque that is being revealed at Abbey Road Studios this week. It'll obviously be past history by the time you hear this, honouring Alan Blumlein for his contributions to the war effort. And it was just a really great story. I mean, Blumlein is well known to most of us in the audio engineering field as the guy who came up with the idea of two figure eight microphones placed 90 degrees to each other. And we refer to it today as a Blumlein pair. And the idea is that if you have one figure eight microphone sort of at 45 degrees to, you know, the source that you're trying to record, and another figure eight microphone at 90 degrees to that, so it's also at 45 degrees to the source you're trying to record, but in the opposite direction, the four nodes of influence, if you like, from those two figure eight microphones give you a genuine stereo signal without any phase discrepancies, and it's a very nice way to record stereo. It's generally my default. If I need to record something in stereo, I generally go with a pair of figure eights if I've got them. It just gives you a very true, very genuine stereo image. So anyway, this whole story was just all about Blumlein and some of the contributions he made during World War II. I didn't realize this, but he was pretty much the inventor of airborne radar. And a whole bunch of other things, apparently. And so there's this ceremony taking place this week. In fact, it's probably already taken place as I'm recording this, because I'm recording on Thursday night before Good Friday. So it's probably already occurred, because the story said that it was happening. Blumlein will receive long overdue recognition on Wednesday, when a commemorative plaque will be unveiled in his honour during a special ceremony at Abbey Road Studios. Really interesting story, and I thought it's good to see. I mean, like so often is the case, recognition comes way too late for some people. You know, guy's been dead for, you know, 60 odd years or something, and we're only just getting around to recognizing him officially. But it's a good story. Anyway, the link will be in the show notes if anyone wants to check that out. And I will also put up a link to the Wikipedia article regarding Blumlein stereo pairs. If you're interested in trying that approach in recording in stereo with a pair of figure eight microphones, the Wikipedia page will give you a bit of a head start on how to set that up if you haven't already got it, from what I've told you. Something else I came across this week was a very interesting story about how a lot of people cannot tell the difference between a 16-bit recording and an 8-bit recording. I was a little bit sort of skeptical when I saw this. I thought, what? How can people not be able to tell the difference between 8-bit and 16-bit? Now, the interesting thing was that the first piece of music they used as a sample was a piece of music that, you know, is very modern, very synthetic, lots of keyboards, lots of distortion, as a natural part of the music itself. And the piece in question is Gangnam Style by Psy. So I was kind of thinking, well, yeah, that stuff's going to have been absolutely slammed in mastering. It's going to have come out looking like a piece of 4x2. You know, maybe the quantization noise that you would normally associate with an 8-bit signal is going to be so far below the, you know, absolute square wave that is the rest of the music that maybe, you know, it will be difficult to discern. And I have to confess, It was difficult to discern. But interestingly, there was also a link to another piece of music, which had been put up as a 16-bit and as an 8-bit file, and it was a snippet of Neil Young's Rockin' in the Free World from the album Freedom, which came out about 1989, I guess. So long before the loudness war really took off. We were certainly listening to CDs in those days, but the practice of absolutely slamming everything into a peak limiter hadn't really taken hold. That didn't really start to gain traction until the early 90s, sort of 91, 92. And I've got to say, it was still tricky. I was surprised. I thought it would be much more noticeable than it was. I could pick it, but not as easily as I thought I would be able to. So by all means, go and check out the link and see whether or not you can tell the difference between a 16-bit signal and an 8-bit signal. And be prepared to be shocked, I'm telling you. I honestly thought it would be a lot easier. There you go. Live and learn. Something I saw on Facebook today, this was interesting. Rupert Neve on April Fool's Day put up a few bogus stories and products, which were great for a laugh. And some of the comments were fantastic. But then today they put up a new thing saying, this one's not an April Fool's joke. We've got a new piece of kit coming and we want to give one away. And it's obviously a new microphone. There are some, teaser photographs that show, a close-up of a microphone grill. But there is absolutely no indication as to what style of microphone it is. But yeah, knowing that it's Rupert and it's SE Electronics, I'm sure it will be quite an impressive microphone, regardless of whether it's another active ribbon, which Rupert seems to have got quite a taste for lately, or whether it's a condenser. So, they're obviously looking for people to use their social media connections to try and spread the word. I have tweeted it and I have put it on my Facebook wall and now I'm putting it on the podcast, and the link will be in the show notes. So if you want to throw your hat in the ring and potentially pick up a brand new Rupert Neve SE Electronics microphone for your cupboard, then head on over and join in. Be interesting to see what they come out with. I guess the chances of winning are very, very slim because every man and his dog's going to go in it, but hey, got to be in it to win it. Now, I've got to say, I am a little bit surprised. I've covered two parts of this epic email that Rob Bettler sent me, and I've not heard from him since. I don't know if Rob's fallen off the edge of the earth, or if he's just waiting for me to get through all four parts before he responds, or what. But anyway, I'm moving on because I'm quite interested in conversation regarding these last two topics of conversation that he included in this epic email. So this is part three, our unbearable incredulity about the future. Allow me to bring up two previously discussed topics. The first one is the 10 Rules of Design by Master Dieter Rams. This time, I'd like to elaborate on rule number one and its implications. Is innovative. The possibilities for progression are not, by any means, exhausted. Technological development is always offering new opportunities for original designs, but imaginative design always develops in tandem with improving technology and can never be an end in itself. Can it be adapted to audio? Yes. Hardware and software audio technology is constantly evolving. There is no reason to become swamped or declare it complete. Here's the problem clearly stated by IBM's Thomas Watson in 1943. Quote, I think there is a world market
for maybe 5 computers. End quote.
Yeah. And Rob, that reminds me of the quote fairly famously attributed to Bill Gates, and I think it was about 1982 when he said, "Who is ever going to need more than 128 kilobytes of RAM?" And you just kind of go, how is it possible for guys like that who know so much about, you know, the industry in which they work, how can they be so blinkered? How can they not understand that there is always going to be room for improvement, and that, you know, you can never assume that, you know, the technology you have today is the limit of it, you know, and the, you know, based on today's technology, it'd be like saying today, you know, no one's ever going to need more than a terabyte of RAM. Well, you know, I guarantee within 5 years, our smartphones will have that, you know, and then there'll be some new type of computing, you know, like quantum computing that they're talking about now, or, you know, any number of other potential technologies could come along that just completely make all of our computers completely irrelevant, you know? So who's to say? Anyway, Rob's missive continues.
The problem is that we all become a little short-sighted like Thomas Watson and declare an idea or field complete. For example, imagine you could time travel back to the year 2004 and tell people 512 gigabyte SD cards would be available and 32 gigabyte SD cards would be a dime a dozen in 2015. You would be upset at their incredulity, right? Yet in the year 2015, we still have this reaction.
And he's got a mock-up of a SanDisk SD card that says 16 terabytes with 95 gigabyte per second transfer rate.
When we hear the words 16 terabyte SD card, we just freeze, then make, oh, come on, faces. In 2015, the thought of 16 terabyte SD cards elicits the response people would have had in 2004, incredulity. The same can happen with audio and its applications and how, despite being given a clear roadmap, we still doubt and we just express default incredulity. The same incredulity is expressed whenever we consider the future of audio, as most likely it will not be what we expect, and possibly it may just bypass the cumbersome process of agitating the molecules in the air, and future audio may just become direct stimulation of cochlear, vestibulocochlear nerve. Would audio still be audio if inaudible to anyone else but the user? Let's not forget that audio in its ancient beginnings was meant to be shared by random listeners. Yet the prospect of making it so incredibly silent to others, thus private, in future restricted models may be the end result of anti-piracy dogma. Think about it. What better way to prevent unauthorized use than to make it inaudible? How much may this draconian trend of preventing quote-unquote unauthorized use harm creativity in the near future? I could count in the hundreds the bands I found out about because friends that initially gave me a file or I randomly heard a song recorded a snippet of it on my phone and then looked it up on Google or SoundHound. Several times ended up buying the song. What if all that was gone? What if I had no way of discovering audio in the future? Don't get me wrong. Most likely, the greed of the higher-ups in the future music industry would undoubtedly allow for some authorized use of promotional material, but the deformed boundaries between unauthorized versus authorized tend to be an ethical problem. Allow me to give you one example. In the summer of 2013, I was on my way to the metro, subway, tube, and under a colourful Coke-themed tent, there was an 18-19-year-old guy giving out little cans of Coke Zero to the public, and he handed me one. I took it, looked at it, took off my headphones, and told the guy, "Hey, this is illegal. This Coke is piracy." He gave me this truly quizzical look mixed with confusion, almost as cockroaches were crawling up his ass. Then he said, what? I then said, "You are giving me a copy of a product Coca-Cola should be charging me for. Why are you sharing this? Who authorized you?" I then smiled, and he caught on to my trolling, and he smiled back, and he said, "Oh, I see, but this isn't music or a movie." I then told him in the same comically outraged tone of voice, "Yes, but this Coke is worse than piracy. A copy of a song is not even physical, but this can of Coke is 100% real, and they don't make a dime off it. Why are you hurting the Coca-Cola empire, dude? Why are you so pirate?" The way I pronounced "hurting" made him laugh, and then we spoke for a good 10 minutes, it was a slow time of the day, about the contradictions of companies and how they make zero money on a Coca-Cola Zero mini can, but they expect people to like it and buy that product later, and how we do the same with music. People may give others a song expecting them to like it, and companies make their money later when people buy other songs or concert tickets, but for some effed up reason, both models are supposed to be entirely different, and one of them undeniably evil. Yes, it is a highly divisive topic, and that is why I brought it to the table. If you decide to include it, I would like to hear comment from you and your audience.
Rob, that is an absolutely fantastic analogy. You know, the idea that, yeah, I mean, heaps of companies do exactly that. You know, I've experienced exactly the same thing, you know, walking to the train station over the last 5 weeks while I was off the motorbike, you know, and catching the train. And there was a day there where, you know, as I rounded the corner to jump on the escalator down underground, there's this guy handing out packets of Arnott's Shapes, or something like Arnott's Shapes. Maybe it wasn't Arnott's, I can't remember, but it was a product like that. Yeah, and you're right. They give away the product for free on the, you know, the hope that you will enjoy the product and then go and buy some. And yet, magically, the music industry, you know, can't grasp that concept. And yet, I'm absolutely the same, you know. I've received, you know, music given to me by other people that I have not paid for, which has caused me to discover artists that I would never have, you know, come across on my own, or, you know, maybe I would have, but it would have taken me a whole lot longer to discover them. And as a result, I've ended up going and buying, you know, albums by those artists, or, you know, or as you say, yeah, paying for concert tickets. Yeah, that is such a weird situation, you know, that different sectors of industry can view the exact same method of promoting a product in such totally different ways. You know, that one industry can see it as a perfectly valid marketing technique, you know, of giving away product, which, you know, obviously it has cost them money to produce that sample product. Okay, sure, they're much smaller packets or cans or whatever it is that they're giving away than what you would traditionally then go and buy, because it is only a sample, but nonetheless it costs them money to do it. Yeah, and one industry finds that a completely valid marketing approach. Yeah, give away some product for free. Those people who like it will go and buy enough of it that it will offset the cost of all the samples that we gave away, including the samples that went to people who didn't end up buying the product. So, yeah, you got to wonder, why is it that the music industry can't see that? Why can't they get it? You know, let music be available, and, you know, the people who buy it will offset the cost of, well, I mean, geez, it's bits. It's just digital data. It's not like there's a real tangible cost. I mean, yes, there's a cost of, you know, R&D, if you like, you know, of finding the band, nurturing the band, buying, you know, booking the studio time and getting mastering done and photo shoots and artwork prepared and all that sort of stuff. Yes, there's a cost to preparing it, but, you know, once the songs are mastered, I mean, they're just digital files, so the distribution is pretty much nil. You know, so, you know, it's not like manufacturing bucket loads of a product. You know, it's not like handing away, you know, CDs by the thousands, you know. Yeah, very interesting. I would love to hear anybody else's thoughts on this. And obviously Rob would as well. So if you've got any other thoughts to add to that idea, please drop me an email, studio@audiotu.com, or you can flick me a message on Facebook, or you can reply to the show notes on the website, just as a comment there, and I'll pick up your replies there. Yeah. Good stuff, Rob. Thank you, mate. I appreciate it. That was a nice thought-provoking piece. So we've got one more section of Rob's epic email to go. I will close it off here and wish those of you who follow such things a happy Easter, and I will talk with you again in a fortnight. And until then, take care.
Sign Language.
Another audiotu.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out
signlanguagepodcast.com
or search the iTunes Music Store. For questions, comments, and feedback, email studio@audiotu.com.